Welcome back to the Outdoor Adventures Podcast. Today in the studio, special guest, Chris Hayden.
Good morning.
How are we doing, Chris?
Pretty good.
Yeah, Chris is one of those dudes that we can go, I don't know, 6-8 months without talking to each other, and then all of a sudden we'll talk to each other for 30 days straight.
Yeah. You know? It's been that way for a while now.
Yeah. I don't know how long we've known each other, but
I think about 9 years almost.
That's
this
crazy.
November, I think, will be 9 years.
That's a lot longer than I would have thought.
It doesn't seem, it's because when I met you when I bought my house. Mm-hmm.
On a cold call. I called you on a cold call.
It was on a cold call, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I was paying for a service called Commissions Inc., and you were a lead on that service.
I really?
Yeah. I don't know how you got into it. You must have Google searched something.
Well, I think my wife and I were at the time looking to buy a house because rents, which it's hard to say this now, but rents back then were starting to increase rapidly every year, and looking back, it was nothing compared to what people are paying nowadays.
I know, isn't it? Even like those mortgage payments back then seemed high, but now they seem so cheap.
The most I've ever paid is half as much as what my friends are paying now.
I know, isn't that wild?
And I don't know how people survive. But
I know times are changing, though. Everything's always changing.
That's for sure.
So Chris and I have been, I guess you're my new roadshow buddy. So we went up to the big sportsman show. But before that, Senate Bill 769 was coming out. And for whatever reason in me, I maybe talking on here or just whatever, I started getting stirred up about the bear and cougar thing. And I actually looked into repealing that old bill that passed 30 years ago. And I did all the research, and I was going to start looking into that. Well, just kind of happenstance, I end up going on a podcast with my buddy Bryant, the Oregon First podcast, and he had this guy on there, John Stallone from Howl for Wildlife. And John said, hey, let's talk off the air. There's some stuff that's going to be coming pretty soon, and maybe we want to pump the brakes. So he kept connecting me with his partner at Howl, and they said, hey, we got something coming pretty soon that could, you know, get started on the cougar situation in Oregon. And so anyway, the way they are with those things, they keep it kind of quiet until they launch it because there's so much opposition and anti-hunting groups. They don't want them to get a head start. And so they launched this proposition, which was Senate Bill 769 here in Oregon, to basically allow the hunting of cougars with hounds, but leave it up to each county to decide, you know, how they were going to handle that. And kind of a workaround to that original bill that made it illegal 30 years ago. And so it was a big effort. I mean, I got the phone call that evening. I blasted everyone I know in the hunting community. And I said, you guys got to come out for this and either show up in person or do your testimony electronically. And Hal gave us some canned ways of doing that. And so anyway, I had intended to go to the in-person public hearing, which was February 11th. And unfortunately, had a livestock issue at my home. I lost two of my animals that evening, and I don't know if they froze to death or whatever, but it was a really old sheep and a really old goat, and I had to deal with those. So I called the court and said, hey, I'm not going to be able to be there. But Chris, the man, the legend, went to that public hearing.
Yeah, it was my first time ever going to anything at the Capitol. And I would say probably in person testifying, there were 25 to 40 people, at least in the room. And they had so much turnout on there's three ways you could testify, I guess we could say. You could do it in person. You could do it through Zoom, which they had, I think, between 130 and 150 people on the list for Zoom. And then you had what I think a lot of people did, which was do a write-in testimony, which is a good way, like we just spoke about, of showing support. It's a little bit less personal, I think, but it's a good way to show numbers in favor of something. The issue I saw mostly was because there were so many people through Zoom, they only gave you a minute and a half to testify.
So you had to be on your game and ready.
And it goes incredibly fast. I had intentions of testifying in person. I'm kind of glad I didn't, because I know, like, after watching people, I wouldn't have been as prepared as you need to be to make the point, right? And I would say that in person, predominantly, the majority of people there were in favor of the proposition, the Senate bill. There were people who were against it, like the director of PETA for the state of Oregon, which we can kind of get into how they operate maybe on another podcast. Now, the people that testified through Zoom were majority against that. There were a few people that were for it. And we even had someone that voted for the ban in 94 that was for this Senate bill, which I was kind of pleasantly surprised to see that.
Yeah, that they've seen that it didn't work the way. So, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit, but we'll reiterate it. In 1994, when that bill passed, I was a 15-year-old kid, and I remember the propaganda. You know, there was all these commercials of, and I don't think TV has the influence it used to back then, because people have found ways to avoid commercials. But back then, you know, everyone sat around on Friday, and we'd watch TGIF on ABC or one of the channels, you know, and you'd watch these goofy shows. But anyway, these commercials would come on, and there'd be this mama bear with cubs running from these snarling hounds up a tree, and then the hunter would shoot it, you know, and it'd roll down the hill, and it probably wasn't even filmed in Oregon, most likely, or who knows where they got the footage from, but it made people think, oh man, hunting with dogs is really cruel, and this is a horrible thing. And so anyway, it was banned in 1994, and the margin was not significant. I mean, it was close, but it wasn't like, it was enough for, I mean, I want to say it was like 450,000 to 550,000 or something like that. So it was, yeah, you know, a million people voted on it, and, you know, the majority won. And we've had 30 years of no hound hunting in Oregon for cougars and bears. And our deer population is suffering, and it's suffering from multiple different reasons. But you got some real raw stats there too, as far as the cougar stuff.
Yeah, we heard in the hearing that ODFW suspects the population is around 7,040 cougars, which...
And that's total counting kittens and everything, probably?
I would think so. And I don't even know how that they had have come up with that number. How do you get population count on an animal that's rather elusive? I have never really seen one in the wild. I mean, I've seen one dead that someone had shot, and that's one my whole life, you know. And in 94, I was 8 years old. I wasn't even hunting yet. So not hunting with hounds is the only thing I've ever known.
Well, let's do some quick math. So I've heard other stats that there's probably 3,500 adult cats. So let's just go with that number.
That's so high.
So let's say there's 3,500 cougars in the Oregon population. And in that meeting, you were also told that an adult cougar takes one deer per year, one deer per week.
Per week.
But two per week if it's feeding kittens.
Yeah.
So let's just use the one a week. So we got 3,500 cats taking a deer a week. There's 52 weeks in a year, so we go 3,500 times 52. That's 182,000 deer.
Let's say it's even half as much.
Yeah, still 90,000.
It's a number I think that's not fathomable.
Well, when our population is like 140 to 160,000 mule deer, I mean, granted, there's blacktail in those numbers too, but when we've got that count and they're worried about mule deer and the populations aren't growing... Well, they're not growing because all the babies are getting eaten, you know,
well,
and the adults.
Yeah, they said deer. Elk are a deer species, the largest one we have in the state. So I don't know. They didn't really give a breakdown. I don't think there was time for that to say, hey, 20% are elk and 30 and 30 or, you know, they didn't have time for anything like that. A lot of the arguments in person or through Zoom that were in favor of it is... that this is a tool to be used by counties to affect the population, right? Mm-hmm. To bring down the population. You saw people from a gentleman we ran into at the sportsman show who was for the Oregon
Trappers Association.
Yeah. He was there. There was also another two other gentlemen that were professional trappers for the state who testified that in the past, before the ban and right around the time of the ban in the 90s, that they were trapping a multitude of different animal species, raccoons, possums, all kinds of stuff. And now predominantly they're just doing cougar work. So I think that's a great indication that there's a there's an issue with the population. So a lot of the arguments for it were that it's a tool that we should use to manage the population. Now, some of the arguments against, which I was surprised to hear, in person, I don't want to say
in before person. We dive into that, let's set the stage a little bit. So you're in a courtroom type room.
It's a small courtroom. Okay. There's probably about 40 chairs in there. And you're obviously looking forward. There is...
is there a panel of the people proposing the Senate bill? Like
there is. The one that I remember was Nash.
Senator Nash, yeah.
He seems to be the one that is for this. Mm-hmm. Predominantly out of the three or four senators that were there. They had an assistant. I can't quite remember her name. And I just sat in the back and watched.
Mm-hmm. And how many people in the room again, you think?
Maybe 40. There was this strange moment that someone, I got to talk about this because it's really weird, that someone had brought in a group of young ladies from the FFA, and they came in and they sat for...
Like on their fancy FFA outfits.
Yeah, yeah, they stand out, right?
Yeah.
So
it's like they blue velvet.
Yeah, strange. They sat for about a half a dozen testimonies, and then they got up and left. So maybe they were being introduced to how our government works.
Yeah, like an educational moment.
I would think so. Mm-hmm. So there's maybe about 40 people in the room.
Because what was your timeline? How long were you there?
An hour and a half.
Okay.
I was there for an hour and a half. I was unsure how long it was going to go for. They didn't really say at the beginning. There were a lot of people that were supposed to testify. Like, they just had a list of names. And they would go through them, and they would call your name. Mostly this was Zoom, that mm-hmm. people weren't, okay, you're not there, well...
On to the next one.
On to the next one.
Or if the person starts talking, and it's like...
bad there was a couple of those, you know...
So is that on like a big screen in the room?
It was, yeah, okay. A giant screen, a projection screen. I will say that the people testifying in person that were against were predominantly from organizations. Mm-hmm. There was kind of two types of people or two arguments I noticed for against this Senate bill. One was based in scientific study, where people would say that there are studies that show that hunting or harassing cougars with dogs has actually no effect on the population. It does not deter them from having a conflict with humans or livestock, and that it's not as selective as people say it is, which I find that hard to argue with, because you run a semi-adult or a juvenile animal to adult animal up a tree, you don't have to shoot it.
Yeah, you can decide.
You can decide. It's a little bit more selective. Now, I could not say if it's more selective between male and female animals. I just don't know.
I would think a seasoned cougar hunter would know if it's a male or a female on a tree.
It's their business to know, yeah. Right? So the other argument against which I thought that I would hear it, but I was surprised because it's my first time in person. It's always something you see on the internet, was the emotional argument. Yeah, I can't even believe I'm going to say this. This is wild because I've talked to my other friends who are hunters about this. There were arguments saying that, and using terms like these animals are murdered, which that it's, I don't know, man. Took taken aback a little bit by that. Mm-hmm. And the trophy hunting big man complex argument. Mm-hmm. One of the people that actually worked on the original bill, I didn't catch her name, testified. And then there was another, a little argument why, and this is the reason why I don't think it will pass. The going against the will of the voters argument. I don't think a lot of politicians want to be on the side of anything that goes against the will of the voters because of the optics of that. The emotional argument which we have talked to a little bit about, is that we want to feel like big, tough men. And I kind of have a problem with that in a way, because you are, you're saying like what my motives are, like, and when you don't know me. And I think that's kind of dangerous in a lot of ways. We've talked several times about this. I don't, if it, this were to pass, I don't even know if I would ever do it.
Yeah. Well, and in that same emotional thread, calling the Cougars victims as well. I remember
that was the other one. Yeah. That's one I couldn't think of right now. Yeah. They're victims, and they're almost giving this charismatic megafauna effect, or adding a sense of personality.
I think there's a name for it, but I may be butchering it, but I think it's
anthropomorphizing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a hard one to say.
Yeah.
But it's basically you're giving human emotions to an animal, which is not how nature works.
No.
You know, animals don't have those same characteristics of humans.
I think mammals have a rudimentary emotion. You see it in elephants, I think, and dolphins, like a little bit more intelligent animals, but I'm sure to a small degree, every mammal has something.
Yeah.
But they're not going to be, you know, cougars are not going to be splitting the atom. You know what I mean? They will never evolve past, I think, what they are now. We'll never know. But when you give, you take away any reasonable arguments when you do that, you know? And another one I heard was a lot of people that were testifying through Zoom too were in more remote areas who couldn't get to that hearing in person. And one person said that, you know, I live in a remote area of Oregon where there are a lot of cougars, and I have a ton of deer in my yard. And I was like, yeah, because you're feeding them.
Yeah. Well, we're not saying they annihilate the population completely, but so the way I look at it, man has already intervened in the natural balance and the natural order of things. So we help control these populations through hunting and through other means. And we are essentially kind of trying to do our best to be good stewards of the land and keep the wildlife at a healthy population. Well, cougars have gotten to an unhealthy population. There's too many of them, and they can harvest too many deer. The piece we didn't talk about is we also have over 30,000 bears in this state. So that cougar that kills once a week, if his kill gets taken by a bear because he buries it and the bear smells it, then he's going to go kill again. So, I mean, the numbers could be way bigger than what we think. And this is just one tool to help manage the population. If you look at other states, like I watch that Mountain Man show quite a bit on Discovery Channel, and they don't shoot the cougars, but they chase them with hounds, they tree them, they run them out of an area where they've been messing with cattle. And that's enough to kind of keep them at bay, you know? And I hunted with a guy antelope hunting, and he had a problem cougar that had attacked his horse, and the horse had run through some barbed wire and got all cut up. And
I mean,
so then, you know, ODFW will let you then bring in a hound hunter. So they brought in the hound hunter. They never caught up to the cat, but they kept pushing it. So the goal was that they pushed it far enough away that it wouldn't come back, you know?
Well, you see, too, in like states like California that have banned cougar hunting at all, the state is spending a tremendous amount of money. Like, I don't have a figure off the top of my head, but they're spending a lot of money to pay houndsmen to harass and kill these cougars when sportsmen would gladly do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's controlled anyway, in a way.
Well, that's the beauty of this Senate bill, is that it's giving control to the counties. It's not taking control from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So they're still monitoring the quotas. They're seeing the effects. It'll be an amazing case study, because you'll be able to say, okay, Harney County, Linn County, Polk County, Multnomah County, 2 out of 4 of you said yes to this. The other 2 said no. What do the deer populations look like in the counties that said yes? And we'll be able to have a measurable impact on what these... Here's the other thing with the hound hunting, and we've talked about this as well, but it's like, you know, who is... Like, to your point is like, how do you know what my emotions to things are? So let's say you've got a family of houndsmen that have been hunting hounds for 3-4 generations, because this went back a long time, right? And they've been raising dogs, and this is just something that was in, you know, their great-great-great-grandfather hunted with hounds. And so they you know, saw that and wanted to do that and be a part of it. Well, we took that away from them 30 years ago. And so that grandfather that wanted to pass that legacy down, he could already be gone. And now maybe his children would still pick it back up again, but maybe they won't. I mean, so how many houndsmen, number one, are left? Number two, it's not like everyone's going to all of a sudden go out and say, we want to be houndsmen, because you got to raise, what, probably 4 to 6 dogs on a dog team?
I would think.
Tons of training. That's a lot of dog poop you got to pick up.
A lot of dog food you got
to
buy.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. You have to really love dogs and really want to do this. And so it's not like there's going to be this explosion of hound hunters should we pass this Senate bill.
And even if it's passed, I mean, I'm sure some counties will do it because there will be pressure. But there is a possibility that no counties do it as well, you know, and we've been hunting animals with dogs for quite a long time, you know, 1,000, 2,000 years. As Europeans come to this continent, it's something that we did. It's a traditional use that in still some parts of this country, you can hunt bears and hounds, you can hunt cougars with hounds. And I just don't want to see something like that die, you know? And you almost need it to be a generational thing to continue it. And when you cut that off at the knees, it will go away. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many houndsmen, I mean, I'm sure we could find out with a little bit of legwork how many houndsmen are left in Oregon. But I would imagine that they might have to bring guys in from other states if there aren't enough guys to have a measurable impact on these animals. And we're not asking for the annihilation of a species of animals. That's one of the other arguments, the emotional arguments I heard was that you guys want to wipe these out. And let's be honest, I don't want to malign anyone, but a lot of these emotional arguments are made by people who couldn't make it from the car to the trailhead. Mm-hmm. They're not out there. And they see hound hunting as something that is, first of all, unsportsmanlike, which I don't see that personally from what I've seen. It goes against fair chase. And I guess maybe you could make an argument in a way for that. I mean, you could at least have that's probably out of all of them, all the things that were said, you could have probably the most argument with. But it's not barbaric, you know?
Well, and from what I've watched on TV with the guys running those hounds, they're covering miles.
20 miles.
Before that animal gets treed. You know, maybe the fair chase element for the human part, yeah, you're covering the miles, but you're not, you know, you're still shooting an animal from a treed position if you decide to take the shot, which you may, again, pass on if it's too small of a cat or whatever. But those dogs, I would argue, they have definitely done fair chase. You know, they've trained, they've conditioned,
yeah,
they've learned behaviors, and hey, the cat's going to do this, or you know, I mean, that's a smart dog that's able to figure that out, or dog team.
Yeah, you know? And I, you know, hate to remind people that a lot of people have these dogs nowadays as pets, when initially they were raised for these. I have a black lab as a pet. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, designed, I guess, in a way for hunting waterfowl.
Yeah.
And I think as hunting has fallen out of favor through the last century in a way, that more people have these dogs as pets, you know, not understanding that, you know, dachshunds, a lot of people have them for pets, made for going into tunnels for rats and small animals.
Yeah.
You know, that's how we came up with these dog breeds, is predominantly for hunting, and in a lot of them for sport hunting for the aristocracy of some European nations, right? That's something as well. But houndsmen are the ones that, in a lot of states, got the protection for these animals.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important aspect of this to remind people that there would not be protections. For a lot of animals, the buffalo... Buffalo Jones was the one that helped, and Teddy Roosevelt helped that happen. It's the same thing with houndsmen. They allowed in many of these Western states and petitioned the government for some form of season, which, you know, something we were going to talk about, we have these synopsises from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And we can see from one year to another that a season gets created.
So let's get into that a little bit. Let's talk about where they came from. And the oldest one we have is from 1967. Yeah. So Chris brought these in.
Yeah, I brought these in when my grandfather had passed. He had a large collection. I mean, you're talking 60 years worth of hunting things. So shotgun stuff, rifle stuff. And he had, I think, a dozen of them. Some had gotten thrown away, but synopsis from the 60s and 70s, which are quite cool because they're paper. Mm-hmm. And they just go through, they're very similar in what we have now.
It's just a lot smaller. It's pocket size. Yeah. It's a little pocket book, I would call it. And it's
typed
bound.
And typed and hand-drawn map of the state of Oregon with units handwritten in. Really, really cool,
I think. They are really cool.
And we see the price of a deer tag was $4 in the 1960s, which is
pretty cheap.
Pretty cheap.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually looked through these before we got started, and we were looking through because we have 67, 68, 69, and then we have 1970. And each book would talk about bear and cougar, but cougar were actually not hunted until 1970 as far as what we could find. So like those first few years they weren't allowed to be hunted. It mentions them, but it says there's no active seasons. Well, in 1970 there was a season from December 1st through December 31st. You were allowed one cougar and they issued 25 tags. So from what we've, unless there was a season prior, you know, then where would these books go? It seemed like that was the first cougar season in Oregon. Yeah.
I have 69 in my hand and they are classified as a game animal in 1969. Well, in the couple previous years.
Yeah.
And it just says there's no open season for the taking of cougar. Landowners who are suffering damage to their property by a cougar are herewith authorized to kill the offending animal and report the occurrence immediately to the nearest game commission or state police office. And then in 1970, they had a season. I don't know if it says what a tag cost in there.
Oh, it probably does in the back, yeah.
Yeah, it can't be expensive.
I wouldn't think so. What's awesome, too, is like the archery hunting photo. Is like this Robin Hood looking dude.
Yeah, pretty for the archer.
You know, just everything's handwritten.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, there's still prohibited methods of take for animals. You could not disguise sex, waste, and the sale of game animals. Prohibited areas to hunt. They had shooting hours. It wasn't the Wild West that I was told, mm-hmm. what, you know, as it was when I was a kid.
Yeah, and it doesn't actually show the cougar tag in the back here. Maybe because they had just rolled it out and there was only 25 tags. It was like, okay, well, whoever actually shows interest in this, then. But I can't imagine it was probably in line with everything else because a hunting license in 1970 was 50 cents, angling license 50 cents. Elk tag, $2.50.
What can you buy for 50 cents nowadays?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's unreal. What are 50 cents is what, 2 bits?
2 bits, yeah.
So you show up with your 2 bits and you're good to go.
Well, we talked about it before the podcast. I don't know how much, I don't want to give anyone any ideas, but, you know, 55 years later, I'm not sure that the price correlates with inflation much.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Well, the other thing that I found before we kind of move on from Senate Bill 769 was your perspective from after going to that meeting, I felt was pretty interesting that you were, maybe a willingness or an open-mindedness to hearing the other side and appreciating their level of passion. Although you didn't agree with the things they were saying, and it hit a chord in you as like when they were saying, hey, you know, these big men that want to pound their chest, you're like, how do you know what my emotions are and what my feelings are? But I did appreciate that you were like, you know, they were very passionate, and granted, it's not passionate in the direction that I am, but I felt like you had at least, because really, I think these issues become political issues, and it's a bipartisan issue. It's an ecology management issue. It has nothing to do with political alliances.
Yeah, and, you know, Senator Nash actually spoke about the urban-rural divide has increased as time has gone on in the state of Oregon. And I think that I'm sure you've heard it, and a lot of people have heard that people who live in these other counties across the state are tired of being told how to live by people in a few counties. Mm-hmm. You hear that all over the country.
Sure. Well, and you hear the Oregon-Idaho movement, where there's those counties that are wanting to break away from the state of that.
Yeah, and I think if that divide wasn't there, you wouldn't have something like that.
Yeah. I always think giving more control to local people that know what the local issues are makes sense.
Yeah, you know? And it's not like ODFW is going to be out of the loop in this. They're going to spearhead it, obviously. They're game animals. They ultimately are going to be in charge. And I do like to see that people are passionate about keeping them. I want them to be around.
Oh, yeah. I don't think any hunter wants cougars eradicated. No. I don't think any outdoorsman. They're a beautiful animal. It's a giant lion in the woods that we hardly ever see.
Hardly ever see.
They're so elusive. They're so intelligent. They're lethal killers.
Yeah, you know? I've spent a lot of time, especially in my youth, in the woods, and I think I have seen one. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen one in the back of a truck in Siletz, where I was hunting Stop Mountain Unit for blacktails. A gentleman and his brother had killed one that morning, and it was cool to see that. And it's, I don't know, maybe if we allowed this, more people would... You know, these people who are against it, maybe if you are capable, because it does take a lot of, you got to be very, it's a physical thing you're doing here.
Oh, yeah. Hiking. Climbing up and down a mountain.
Oh, my God.
It's at a fast pace, trying to keep up with dogs.
At a brutally fast pace.
Yeah.
I think that if you are against something like this, maybe you should go to where it is legal for now. I mean, in other states, they're trying to get rid of it, and just take part in it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that looks like, but I think that would be good for you. Maybe it might change your perception, because alluding to what my motives are in something, like I said, can be dangerous. And you're subscribing a blanket view or to a group of guys predominantly that feel a certain way about something. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I should have known that that was going to be one of the arguments. Mm-hmm. I was just surprised to see it.
But, I mean, likewise, we don't want to put ourselves in a blanket view of the opposition. Like, we need to be open-minded to hunt to other people's opinions and motivations. And I feel like that meeting really opened you to that a little bit.
No, it did. Because, you know, we live in a little bit as... I have friends who don't hunt. I have a lot of friends that do take part in the outdoors in many different ways, but generally speaking, my friends who are not involved don't tell me, you know, that, hey, I don't want you to be doing this or this is wrong. I don't ever hear that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of nice in a way to at least see it in person and not on the internet. Cause that's where a lot of you see the anti-hunting stuff is online.
Yeah.
The video, we've all seen the videos on YouTube. We've all read comments.
People can be a lot more aggressive when we can't see their face.
Oh,
you know, when you're
wild.
Typing on a keyboard.
Yeah. And that goes on a lot of, you know, hot button issues for sure. And I've seen a lot of people be, not so much with hunting, but predominantly with fishing, get really aggressive. And I could see that maybe if you were breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see that, because I don't like it when hunters and fishermen break the law. And,
and
I'm certainly not going to be a part of it, or I'm not going to allow you to do it next to me.
Yeah, you exactly. Know?
And I think that if more of us maybe listen to them a little bit, I think it would help kind of close that divide as best as possible. And look, I really think it's not going to happen.
You got to be positive,
I
am, man.
I hope it does so I can at least go along with it and not have to go to Arizona or Idaho or wherever they're still doing it. But I think it's 60-40 against.
Huh. I hope you're wrong. Like in my
mind. I do too.
In my mind, this is our best shot to protect mule deer. I think cougars are the number one threat to the mule deer population that's suffering in the state of Oregon. And for me, and a lot of biologists would probably say that and agree to it. And so the people that are studying are saying, hey, we need this. So for me, I'm going to stay in the optimist side of the coin and say, hey, this could happen, and it could. And I've told you this, I have no desire to hound hunt. Maybe I would tag along if I had a friend that was doing it, but I really don't have a desire to do it. I just know that it's a means of helping control this cougar population.
Yeah, and I think ODFW is on board with it mostly. I'm sure there are factions of ODFW that have gone more
neutral.
Well, neutral, or you always hear rumblings that the some of the people that are starting to make up these fish and wildlife divisions across the country are more anti-hunting.
A lot of the commissions
are.
They're appointed by the governor.
And, on the West Coast, we're predominantly Democrat ran. I hope it does go. I would love to hunt one in the snow one time.
Yeah.
I think it would be interesting. And I generally like hunting bears. Mm-hmm. I think they're cool. I like being around them. I like being part of people hunting them. And I think just for me, I have no intention of getting 6 dogs.
You're right. And raising them and building a hound team.
I have one. Yeah. And it's a pain now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they're already enough. Yeah. Well, the other thing that I know we've kind of talked a lot, but I was thinking about this topic, and just it really kind of struck a chord with me when you were talking about not knowing someone else's motivations when we've had this conversation previously. And just hunting in general, anti-hunters that are against what I've grown up doing, and like with anything, cultural. So, other cultures, if you look at it as a cultural thing. So, let's say there's a culture in the Congo that harvests monkeys. Well, we see monkeys as these beautiful, similar to human type animal. How could you go and eat a monkey, right? And I wouldn't personally want to eat a monkey, but culturally and historically, maybe they grew up, generation after generation doing that. And so putting that in my shoes, I grew up eating deer meat and having deer hunting be a part of my life and my heritage and my legacy that I want to pass on to my kids. And so for me, my motivation in harvesting that animal is that the meat from a deer, I don't need it, but it's good, organic, lean. There's not a bunch of stuff put in that meat and, dyes and all kinds of different fillers and things like that. I mean, granted, they could eat some pesticides or something. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows what guys are laying out for?
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, that meat brings back my childhood. So when I cook, I usually cook venison once a week on the weekends. And when I take that bite, it's immediately I'm back to 7 years old or whatever. You know what I mean? And just those flavors and those memories. And so to me, that's a cultural heritage kind of thing that I want my kids to be able to partake in, should they choose to. And if we don't do something to help control predators that are taking out deer, they may lose that opportunity at some point. Eventually, so it's like, do you want a balanced environment where every animal is out there living its life? Or do you want an excess amount of cougars that are then starving to death and you don't have any deer anymore? You know?
That's a part of it too. And you talk about the cultural aspect of it. We've been hunting with dogs for a millennia. I mean, you brought up people in the Congo. They hunt with dogs in the Congo for antelope species called the bongo. Mm. I know.
It's the bongo in the Congo.
Yeah, it's incredibly expensive. I watched some videos on it. And that's because of the terrain, incredibly thick jungle. We've hunted with them in Europe, in Asia. And I bet if you went to South America, someone did it there. I mean, it's part of that partnership with dogs that humans have had for a very long time. And we kind of had coexisted, I would think, with each other. It's a great way for both of us to get some food.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to see that, go away. One of my friends said, brought it up, hey man, the Romans did it, but that doesn't mean it's barbaric like they were. Mm. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good point.
And you look at most of us experience with dogs is bird hunting, so most of us have bird hunted with dogs and seen a dog. I've only done pheasant hunting with dogs and in South Dakota, and seeing those dogs work those cornfields and just their excitement. I mean, they're bred for that purpose and they're trained for that purpose and they love it. Like they go all out until they're totally exhausted and we got to go cool them off in a pond. You know, you have to give them a break because they'll just, they'll hunt themselves into the ground if you let them because they love it so much.
Yeah, we still talk about, you know, I've hunted with dogs that weren't mine. I had bought my lab 9 years, about the time that we had met, for the purpose of hunting with it. But once I brought that puppy home, my wife was like, no way.
Right? Yeah. It's you're not dog. Taking my baby.
Yeah, which is okay, you know?
Yeah.
But I've hunted with them over ducks. We do the bantail pigeon season here. And we still talk about some of the good dogs that people have had or my family have had. And, you know, we talk about my grandfather with these regulations. He would always have like funny terms. Like if a dog was real good, he's like, that's a Cracker Jack dog. I'm like, what? I never understood it as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or if it was a bad dog, like not good at hunting, it's a soup hound. And all it's good for is feeding it soup.
That's funny.
Yeah. Cause he had old timey old man sayings, you know, but we would always admire dogs that, cause everyone would try. I mean, look, these people with the dogs that I hunted with tried their best in training them. And sometimes you just get lucky and you have a dog that's exceptional. Mm-hmm. And my uncle had one named Lucy, and that dog was so smart, man. And it's fantastic to watch them work.
Yeah. My dad always talks about a German short hair my uncle's had named Fritz.
Yeah.
And I guess Fritz with a pheasant. He just lived for hunting. And I mean, he actually died in the field and just hunted all the time. I mean, that's
kind of
died doing what he loved.
Yeah. That's kind of the way to go.
Yeah. So, I mean, Senate Bill 769, let's hope it passes. Let's just hope it even gets on the voters pamphlet.
Well, that's going to be the first hurdle.
I don't know what the next steps are after the public hearing. I know it's out there and you can Google it and it'll tell you what their next pieces are, but I'm sure they have to gather signatures.
So spread the word if you're for this in any way.
I think hunters and outdoorsmen, I think a lot of times we tend to be like, oh, I don't want to be a hound hunter, I don't really care. But it's all about the population, and if the population is suffering, then all of us are suffering, and tag quotas are going to go down and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, you think it's bad now.
Yeah. Just wait.
The population's
good. Well, because didn't they tell you what they thought cougars were growing at? What rate? Did they say that in the meeting?
You know, I was really hoping that they had published the video so we could have actually gone back and watched it.
I feel like they threw out a number, though, and it was high, higher than I thought. Because when I looked at the old data from
17%?
Yeah, it was something like that. I want to say you said 17%, and that's insane if they're really growing that fast. Because back in the day, they were supposedly growing at 4%.
Well, and it's compounding.
Yeah, true. Yeah. But if they were growing at 4% back when measuring in 1994, I think it's measure 18 when it passed, we'd have over 9,000 cats based on the growth rate at that time.
Yeah.
So,
and, you know, I think you'd have to look, and that's why I can't wait till it's published. So maybe we could. I always thought another good podcast would have us watch it.
Yes. I would love to watch it too.
Yeah. Because there are some people that alluded to studies that have been done about the effects and how, like I said earlier, it doesn't have an effect, but I want to read those.
Yeah.
And see if that's what it really says.
Agreed. Well, we've beat Senate Bill 769 to death, but I think it's important to talk about this stuff.
It's very important.
So let's move on to our next thing, so you and I went up to the big show, the big Portland Sportsman Show. I think it was the 50th year of this show.
Is that really?
Yeah, I think it was the 50th anniversary. I mean, I know Jim Shockey was there on one of the evening talks and the Born and Raised guys. There's lots of different people that show out for this thing. And I've never gone to any of the seminars, but they always sound so cool. Like one guy was talking about bluefin tuna fishing off the coast in Oregon. And
oh, really?
Yeah, there's always topics that I always want to check out. But one of these years, I'm going to like be like, okay, I'm blocking out these 3 days and I'm going to hit some of those seminars. But this was one of those years where Chris and I beat the weather. So we went the opening day of the show, and he always goes the opening day, which is a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking, okay, it's not going to be that busy. And then we get there, and there's this huge line of trucks getting into the place.
I couldn't believe it's never been that busy on a Wednesday.
Yeah, it was crazy. But it could have been because we knew that snowstorm was coming in.
Which it did the next day.
Yeah. So then the snow was here for a couple days, and it would have probably been a lot more messy. But we also both were late for things we had to do because the traffic leaving was insane.
Oh, you know? Boy.
Like, yeah. It took us, what, 4 or 5 hours to get home?
Yeah, so, it seems like that. It was a pretty good show. We talked to a couple guys that I know, I've been talking to for a couple of years.
Hotfire Safaris. Yeah.
They're cool, man. They're just too...
I've got one of their brochures here. And I mean, so Chris has wanted to hunt with these guys and do the
3 years now.
South African safari hunt for a while.
Yeah. I had intentions of last February of putting a deposit down, but then my construction company kind of started taking off, and I knew I couldn't get away. Same kind of thing is happening this year, to where I know that I it's not responsible. Like, I need to be here.
Let's get a shout out to the construction company. Yeah, what's the name?
Archer Construction and Remodel. Mm-hmm. We do a little bit of everything: kitchens, baths, roofs, you know, exteriors, build houses. So
yeah, it's going good.
It is going. It's good, and if it keeps going good, I'll be there sooner than I think. Hopefully. Right.
Well, that's what the guys at Hotfire were saying, and they were like, "This was my first time meeting them." Such cool guys.
They're really cool. And they have this kind of mentality on the property that they do own, or their families have owned, was predominantly cattle land. And they're trying to rewild the areas, which I think is awesome. Mm-hmm. And they start talking about, you know, all these crazy animals that we don't have here. And we had a great talk with them about what does it mean to be a native animal, mm-hmm. which I thought was very interesting, because these guys are white and they consider themselves Africans. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been there for a couple hundred years. And I always make the argument that the wild pig in America is a native animal after 400 years.
Yeah.
Like, I think I would consider that a native animal at some point. But they were, they always have like a very rudimentary booth, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
Which I like. Like that. I
mean, keeping it simple.
Keeping it simple. They're pretty booked up, from mm-hmm. what I understand, every year.
And these guys, you could see, could go up and down a mountain. They were
they're studs.
Fit dudes. Yeah.
Yeah. And they've been doing it, you know, I mean, they've been in the wild as South Africa gets, since they were kids, mm-hmm. you know. And, they're cool guys. There's a lot of booths there for guides, which was... you know, we found a DIY moose hunt, which I thought that was very reasonable. An elk hunt is still really expensive, you know, like $15,000, which I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, that DIY moose hunt was in Alaska, and that guy, I think it was him and his daughter that were
10
there.
10 days, like $3,500 or something?
Yeah, because you paid just the lodging fee, basically. Yeah. But I mean, you probably had to buy tags on top of that.
Yeah, I think the tags were only... I mean, you're under $1,000, I think, with the hunting license and the out-of-state tag.
And they're feeding you and taking care of you. You're paying, I think it was $350 a day for his lodge, basically.
Yeah, but you get a boat with that.
Yeah.
Which is cool, a lot of good fishing.
Yeah, you get a fish and you get to go out moose hunting. And yeah, that did seem pretty cool.
That was a good idea.
Because that's something I'd like to do. The other one, you've already fished with these guys in Mexico, but what
Baja Pirates of La Paz.
Yeah, the Baja Pirates of La Paz, but then they have another one called Something Bay.
Yeah, so... they are out of Gold Beach. I fished with them 5 years ago.
Out of Gold Beach, Oregon?
Yeah, they're actually out of Gold Beach.
Oh,
the owner. Okay. I actually met them. We're going to talk about it after this at the Saltwater Fishing Expo in town.
Yeah,
I met them there in 2019, I think, with one of my other buddies, and we just decided that day, like, hey, we're just going to go to Mexico. And we fished on the Sea of Cortez side. Mm-hmm. They have a new lodging area on the Pacific side. I can't remember where the area is, but it's a stark difference. Like, La Paz is a city of 300,000 people.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. And they have casinos. It's there's a part of the area that's really, like, it's beautiful. And then there's parts where it's like, looks like the third world. It's really strange. This new area they have is incredibly remote. It has no paved streets, no street lights. But from what they said, the fishing is incredible.
That's what he said. Some of the best fishing in the world.
Yeah. So it's a little bit more money and you can look these guys up. The prices are actually very reasonable.
Yeah. I got excited about that. Just cause
you should go, dude. Yeah, it's so much fun.
I've got some bucket list fish that I want to catch. And
rooster fish, right?
That's yeah. Rooster fish definitely on the list. They're so cool.
I didn't catch one when I went. It's so funny. We fished with the same guide. We got him by accident. And then we fished with him. I think that trip I fished three days. But he was just cool. You know, it's nice to get a guide that is just seems awesome, loves to fish. And so he took us to this beach you can only get to by boat. Mm. It's just the water, just beautiful, right? Just picturesque. Yeah. And he's hanging out in the boat. And he's like, hey, screaming from the boat with this giant rooster fish he just caught.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, what? I've been wanting to catch one my whole trip.
Yeah, let me hold that thing for a picture.
It was big. Yeah. And he just threw it back in the water. I mean,
they're so cool looking.
They're cool. They're unlike any other fish. Mm-hmm. They're easier to catch from what I understand. I haven't caught one, but all the guys I've talked to, they're easier to catch from a boat casting to shore. Mm. The real challenging way, I guess you would say, is from the beach with a fly rod.
Oh, yeah.
They say that is...
That's like the bone fishing thing, too.
Yeah, that permit, way. Right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
So I'm hoping, if everything goes well this year, we'll go. Go fishing again.
Little business trip, you know?
I would like to. My business partner's never been down to Mexico.
Yeah.
And I told him, I'm like, you're going to like it.
You guys go down there, you look out some new construction materials.
Yeah.
The IRS says as long as you do some business on the trip.
I'll have my meeting, my yearly meeting.
Yeah, exactly. There. You have a half a day meeting. Yeah. Follow whatever the rules are. And then...
The fishing, I think, is... I mean, you can go to Hawaii. I've never fished there. A lot of my friends have. But I think if it's for me spending my money... I would rather go to Baja and fish. Mm. The people are awesome. The food is great. Beer costs nothing.
I got excited about that after hanging out with those guys and talking. Yeah, and just hearing your stories from when you went before. And I would say just the sportsman show in general, I thought this year, probably one of the better years as far as just how the booths were laid out.
Yeah.
I mean, like the meat eater guys were there. There was guys from everywhere. Yeah. We didn't really hang out at that booth or anything, but you picked up a fly rod.
I did a little 3-weight for trout fishing in Central Oregon from, I think, Maxim Outfitters. It was like
good price. Like the rod. It was very nice guys.
Yeah, it's very nice. You know, it's just also, too, it's aspects of it are just like any other sportsman show that have been up there. I mean, you can buy a boat or $150,000 pickup. I mean, ATVs.
I always do all the little raffles to try to win a fishing trip or win. I'm a sucker for those. I never win.
This is my first year. I haven't done them because I've never won them.
I never went either.
Throwing away $100 every year. So
I always get excited. Yeah, I started thinking about that on the gun raffles at the local sportsman show. I'm like, I've probably put... $25 worth of tickets into those buckets for the last 10 years. That's $250.
Yeah.
You know, it's time to just maybe buy my own gun. Yeah.
Well, and that's something we talked about. We talked to a custom gun maker there. I just don't know if I need it or if I'm there yet.
Cause it's cool.
It's cool, but I mean, you're going to...
But they're necking down their loads and doing all kinds of specialty stuff. It's like...
Well, that's, I think, one of the aspects of custom gun making. You can really... You can get your rifle made in the cartridge that you want.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably not going to be doing too much experimenting, right? I mean, these rifles need to be safe to shoot.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think on the low end, they were $4,400.
Yeah, and those guys, they're local here. I'm to Oregon, so they were in Sutherland, which is, hour and a half, 2 hours south. But they... what was cool about them is they break the rifle in for you.
Yeah.
They have it fully sighted in with whatever optic you want. And I'm assuming they're giving you some of the loads to get you started
And I think in some of the more non-common cartridges, they'll get you some dies made. I would assume so. On the higher end, they were just under like $8,000. Mm-hmm. And that's no optics involved.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, so with optics, depending how crazy, you could be at $10,000.
Well, do you remember what that 300 cartridge, the Norma, 300 Normas, he liked that cartridge a lot. Yeah. And then he had some 7 PRCs that were like neck down, or some 6.5 PRC. They were just
7.65. So it's a necked up.
Mm-hmm. Necked up. Yeah.
Which I think don't they make a 7 PRC?
They do now, 7 PRC, and then there's also that new 7 Backcountry.
That's the one that's probably the only cartridge in the last couple of years that has interested me.
Very hot cartridge, yeah. Hot load, that thing's flying.
So. Yeah, but again, we talk about this all the time. It's like, I still hunt with a 30-06, so I don't need anything.
Yeah. Yeah, we just talked about that this morning, because I have an old 06 that I want to trade in at the gun show today, but it's not like a nice nostalgic, it's a plastic gun that I just don't need in my collection anymore.
Like you might have to come down a little bit if you really want to get rid of it fast.
And I know, but I'm cheap. Not cheap, but okay, I'll get rid of it for this amount, but I'm not willing to, know what I mean?
You just don't want to take too much of a loss.
Yeah, or I'd rather keep it. If it's too cheap, I might as well just hold on to it.
Yeah, if someone says, hey, I'll give you $200 for it, then you might as well just keep it.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going to get anywhere with $200.
But it's a if you were selling at retail, it's a $700 gun probably.
Plus the optics.
That's with optics.
Oh,
it's
is
not
that
a
with
high,
optics?
Yeah. Okay. So, wholesale to another gun dealer is probably $400 is probably where
I guess see what you can get, but yeah. I would just keep it as a backup rifle.
Yeah, so we have a gun show today in Albany. We're going to go check that out after we get done here.
It's one of the better gun shows.
Yeah, Albany Rifle and Pistol Club puts it on.
It's gun shows in Oregon. I've been going to them for a very long time. And Portland can be really good. There's a couple different ones that go to Portland, but the Salem one I went to last weekend.
Oh, right after the Saltwater show.
Yeah, so the Saltwater show, it's a really small sportsman show. It's tailored around saltwater fishing. There are, like all sportsman shows, there's some mocked-up boats that you could buy. Mm. I did not see... There may have been one or two guides there. There's a rod... Edge Rods was there, which is... Gary Loomis, now is Edge Rods. He was there, which that I think is the first year he's there. He could have went last year, I don't remember. And there was a couple other rod manufacturers there that I had not heard of. ODFW was there, which is super cool.
Yeah.
They had a great display of all the crab species of Oregon.
Wow.
And the red rock crab is a native species.
The one that we always say is not.
The guy said, we've been battling this for 100 years. Everyone's uncle had told them that it's not native.
Yeah, that's from Washington, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, it's native here. And I was like, okay, cool.
I didn't even see that booth. I was probably, my head was in the clouds.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Because
I know we have those weird spider crabs that come from Japan that are invasive.
Yes.
And then the green crabs are invasive, and they're starting to worry about them because they're prolific.
They just breed out of control. Yeah. They take over everything. But they had a great display of all the crab species of Oregon. I thought that was pretty cool. There was a booth there trying to get signatures to bring back sea otters.
Oh.
I thought that we had them, but...
I would think that'd be a good thing, because I know
I signed it.
I know we have a sea urchin problem in the Pacific Ocean, and so because the otters have gotten whacked.
Yeah.
And, otters, that's one of their favorite foods. And if you're in Alaska, those things are everywhere. They're like, we have that California sea lion everywhere in Oregon, and those have created a lot of problems with the salmon and whatnot. But, so I don't know. I have mixed reviews of... I do believe in restoring things to what historically used to have been there to a point.
Well, as best as you can.
Yeah.
But we have a problem with, with cougars. We're trying to remedy that. I don't see us having a remedy for the seals and sea lions because they're federally protected. So I just don't see that happening. I signed the sea otter one because, deep down I'm all for all of it,
Yeah. I just my wife loves them. Yeah, they're like the cutest thing,
They are, but they're actually super aggressive.
And savages.
They're savages, dude. Yeah. But they're a really cool animal. And, I've since I've had a kid, You know, I have a 3-year-old daughter. I've gotten softer a little bit, my wife says. So I, you know, and I want, she's starting to, I bought her her first fishing pole. So I want her to see these things.
Yeah.
You know, so I signed it. A lot of fishing rods for sale, and it's all tailored. This show's all just tailored to saltwater. Mm. They do have seminars there as well, for all the offshore, possibilities in the state of Oregon, which I like. Just like the Big Sportsman Show, I've never been to any of them. Because I was just like, go with a friend or a guide.
Yeah, when you're just walking through and...
walking through. It's really small, though. Mm-hmm. It is literally one hall for the actual show. It's tiny, but every year it gets better.
Yeah. Well, and that's how those things start. So this year, we're going to go up for the Hunting Expo, too, which is next... Friday, Saturday, Sunday, March 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Very excited about that one.
Yeah. I think it'll be a lot of the players that were at the Big Portland Show, but it's focused only on hunting. So there won't be any fishing categories.
Yeah. I was going to go this year, try to go to Saskatchewan this year for a bear hunt. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's going to happen because of work, but I would like to go up there just to, you know, just for the opportunity to get a monster black bear. They're just so much bigger there. So, and we'll see. This is the first time this show is coming to Oregon.
Yeah. I think it's been in Washington for a while, the same show. And so, but I looked at the people that are coming and it's all the big names are there. It should be a pretty good show. I'm excited for that one. And you know, we're doing the show circuit now, you know, and it's sportsman show season. February and March is when it all happens. I guess they do that because there's not a lot of hunting going on. Is that probably why?
Just winter steelhead fishing.
Right. And that's kind of probably dying down by now.
It is. Yeah.
I never even went out.
Every time that I had planned to go out, I was just like getting sick from my kid bringing home something.
Yeah, there's been a plague going around the state and everyone's gets, it's like my daughter's on her third round of it and my wife's got it this time. I've gotten it twice, but it's just like a sinusy cold that just never goes away. And
yeah. So my big like free times are December, end of November through beginning of February, basically.
Which makes sense in construction, yeah.
Well, no one wants, like, we do a lot of remodel work, so no one wants you in their house.
For the holidays.
Well, they don't want their kitchen torn apart for Thanksgiving or Christmas, you know, or bathrooms and stuff.
And if it's outdoor work, the weather's too bad.
Oh, man. Yeah. You try to spring through summer that stuff as best as you can, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not in the position to turn stuff down, really, but, I mean, so I was like, oh, great, I'm going to at least fish a bunch because I couldn't hunt a lot. And then I was just got whatever that was going around. And I was just feeling, every time I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, I was like, I'm just feeling bad today.
The motivation wasn't there to go torture yourself.
Yeah, stand in a frozen river. I'm just not interested in it. And now we're starting work for the year. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to pass winter steelhead this year.
So I had a little recent fishing adventure that we wanted to talk about. So one of my bucket list fish. So rooster fish are on there, grayling are on there. Even though I've been to Alaska a few times, I never have targeted them. I need to, because I don't think they're that hard to catch and they're really cool looking. But so, you know, grayling, rooster fish, I've always wanted to catch a tarpon. I've already caught like marlin and oversized sturgeon, and I've hit dorado. You know, I've caught and tuna, and then of course all the salmonids that we have in Oregon. And so I've always wanted to catch. I started becoming a bass fisherman. So I grew up as a trout fisherman, only ever fished trout growing up. And then it turned into salmon and steelhead. It's a little bit of sturgeon here and there. Well, then I moved into this neighborhood 5 or 6 years ago that has this lake. And so I started fishing it for bass. And I realized how fun bass are to catch and how aggressive they are and how, not, I won't say easy, but they'll bite on a lot of different things. You know, they get more difficult the more times they get caught. But so it's a catch and release fishery. I don't have any desire to eat a bass. I've eaten smallmouth bass before, but I'll pass. And so anyway, the company sent us to Miami here last week, and my wife and I on a sales trip. And we had a few business meetings and whatnot. But I was like, you know, while we're here, I should try to find a fishing trip. So I threw that out to the wife, and she wasn't super excited initially by the prospect of it, but it grew on her. She got a spa day. So I got a fishing day. So the last day before we came home, I booked a charter for 4 hours with this guy, and we were fishing the canals of Miami, which is where they draw their public drinking water from. It's 90% fresh and maybe about 10% salt. But these canals hold all kinds of, you know how Florida is the hot spot for things being released and just thriving because the temperature and the conditions are right. So, you know, people throw things out in like boas and, iguanas and chameleons. And so then they just take over.
Well, a lot of times too, that happens when there's a hurricane.
Oh, true. Yeah. Then everything escapes. True. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. And everything gets mixed up and put in different places.
I've seen the photos online where a guy's fishing and there's just a giant goldfish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We saw a ton of those.
That's kind of cool, man.
So we're fishing these canals and you're fishing little jigs or you can fish with live minnows. And our guide, his name is Diego from Stay Fishy. Really cool guy. I had told him specifically I wanted to target peacock bass. And a lot of guys want it. He'll do like some other inshore stuff for like snook and smaller size tarpon and things like that. And I do want to go for a big tarpon, but little tarpon I wasn't really that jazzed about. I really wanted to target the peacock bass. And I just think they're a beautiful fish. And it's basically an overgrown aquarium fish. You know, they're from the Amazon. The record in Florida is 9 pounds.
That's a monster.
And so anyway, we get going and my wife is along for the ride. She didn't really want to fish, but you know, she was there. So we had two rods in the water and kind of, I got to do the fishing. But, the first one we see a large, you can kind of see them, depending on where they're at. So this canal, I guess is like 20 some feet deep. And so sometimes you're just kind of working the shoreline, but then as the sun comes up on your back, you can kind of look on the edge and you'll see them. And they don't necessarily have a spawning season. They bed up all the time. They're always breeding. They're very prolific. And the males and females will guard the fry. So they'll both be on the nest. But sometimes you just get them cruising for food too. So anyway, we get rolling and we start fishing this first little finger. And I catch a little miniature one. I mean, it's just like a dink. And I see a giant.
Yeah.
And he's like, leave that on for a minute and see if he comes up for it. And we couldn't get him to bite. And so he was charging his trolling motor at the truck. So we go back to the truck and get the battery because he always likes to be at 100%. He was at like 94, you know? And so he's just, you know, being a good guide. So we go back and get it and we start cruising to this next spot we want to fish. Second cast, we hook into the biggest fish of the day. And I've got him. He's pulling pretty good. It's a pretty good fish. And he comes up to the surface and Diego's like, big peacock, you know, like don't horse it basically, you know, cause he's fishing. We're fishing 4 pound test. And, so anyway, we get this fish netted and we take pictures with it and it's got all the characteristics you're looking for. It was a big male. He had estimated, like he said, 7 pounds. I think, you know, I'm probably going to put him in the 4 to 6 pound range, 4 to 5 pound range, probably.
Is that him being a good guide?
Probably, yeah. But I mean, also the excitement of the moment. And who knows, he'd know better than me, but it was a good fish no matter what. And just all the colors and all the stuff that I was looking for. So right there, that's my second fish of the day. And I'm like, this trip is good. So we catch probably 10 more of them throughout the trip. And one other decent sized one that wasn't quite as good as that one. But the best fish for me was I could see him on the bed. It was a male and female. And I was throwing out to him. And they would just nudge my bait away from him. But they don't bite hard. They're more of a soft biter. So that was hard for me at first because I would pull a little too hard trying to set like a largemouth bass. And he's like, no, you got to set it a lot softer because they're not always taking it. Sometimes they're just knocking it away from the nest. And so I would see him. I throw my bait out there and I twitch it a little bit, but you're giving a fair amount of line because you're trying to get the fish to take the bait. And anyway, sorry, I'm talking with my hands. I knocked the mouse off the desk. But anyway, so this, I'm casting this fish and they'll nudge it away, but not enough to actually set a hook. And they just kept nudging it away. And finally, I got it just perfect and I had a bunch of line in my hand and I gave it a little twitch and that fish just hammered it. And so that fish took like 20 minutes to get him to finally strike. So that one was the memorable moment for me. And we were both excited because we'd been working on that fish for 20 minutes. But you're seeing like those giant goldfish everywhere. Red Oscars. We caught a striped tilapia. And I didn't realize they have a lot of teeth, so you can't put your hand in the mouth of those. But that was the only other species we got. we did at the end of the day, because we had a little extra time, go to his like juvenile tarpon spot and try to catch some smaller tarpon, but we didn't. They weren't there that day. But there's a bunch of dead iguanas floating everywhere in that same spot. So
that's
weird.
I
mean, he was like, you could eat a fish in here, but I probably wouldn't. You know?
Really?
I mean, the canals of Miami, it's like, you know, it's a fairly urban type fishing. But I mean, I had a lot of fun, crossed the fish off the list. They fight really well. It's weird though, kind of. It just seems like this exotic thing, you know, and you're in Miami.
Cool looking.
Yeah.
And yours was a male, right? So I had the big bump.
That big one is a male, yeah. And I did get a big female too that I took a picture of, and but it's, yeah. The males have that big bump and they have just more vibrant colors. I mean, the females are pretty vibrant as well, but.
It's a cool fish, for
they're
sure.
They're a cool fish.
Yeah, they must be line shy too, fishing with small 4-pound. Mm-hmm. Because when we're, you know, I haven't done a lot of bass fishing, but you can just rip on them here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You watch any bass fishing at all, they're not being shy about setting the hook.
Well, yeah, so this guy's fishing, his main line was braid, but then his leader was the 4-pound leader, and it was pretty long. And then he'd have a little bit of one little teeny split shot on there to get the bait down. And it would either be an artificial, you know, jig type bait or a live minnow. Mm-hmm. And either.
And like the jig size, really small?
Yeah, pretty small. Like, you know, like a little rubber kind of jig, like replicating a something they would eat.
Well, there's a billion bait fish in the canals.
They're probably only eating other fish babies, basically, you know, from all these other different. A lot of them are exotic. I mean, none of them are. Most of the fish that we were targeting are, I mean, peacocks are definitely not native to Florida.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
But again, to your point, like, when do you reach a spot where something's been there long enough that they become native?
I don't know. I think that's a really good question. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, it's mostly around pigs here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not native. And it's like, yeah, but, I mean, a couple
does
centuries.
It matter? Yeah.
Well, like, that's the thing, too. Does it matter? I mean, for the ecology, I think it does, for sure. But for fun, maybe not so much.
And then for taste, you know? I mean, if you're harvesting for meat. But also, like, I've hunted pigs in Hawaii, and we ate it. And it was like something to throw on the barbecue kind of thing. And it was, there's like, I don't remember what the number is, but I want to say it's like 7-1 pigs to humans on, you know? And so like they can really take over an area and do a lot of damage. So those are things I think we should be hunting just to help thin down the population.
And what's wrong with, you know, feeding people?
Yeah.
With them? Like, I mean, hunting in Hawaii is very interesting. Because they have the axis deer going on like crazy there, and the pigs, and it's accessible to us because we're on the West Coast.
Yeah, our friend went with us one year, and she did an axis deer hunt, and they were everywhere.
They're cool deer.
Yeah, they are cool. And she had us over for dinner after we got home, and it was delicious. It was
very good.
Yeah, very tender. What's your next trip? Do you have like a next like something planned that you're going to do?
I had something planned, was going to Saskatchewan.
The
bear hunt. We're building. Hopefully, we'll be done with architectural plans this upcoming week for a house build. And it's a rather large project, so I want to be around for that.
Yeah.
And so I can't really take off. I think I would have been gone for a week. I did tell my wife that those guys, the Baja guys, were there at the show, and she's like, because she went with me.
Mm-hmm.
Her and one of my buddies went, and my wife. She likes offshore fishing.
Yeah.
She generally has a really good time. And so I said, yeah, you know, I told her about it and I said, yeah, but this other place is more remote. And she was like, that sounds better.
Yeah.
And I was like, which is great. It's great to have a wife that's down to do that.
Oh, yeah.
So I think
that could be the next one.
I think, yeah. And I want to say maybe October.
Well,
or November. It depends on when I get done because, you know, I got a lot of other projects signed out through the year, but when I'm done with the house, I'll be like, I think just done for the year.
Well, I'll say I appreciate that about how you're growing your business is this guy, he really wants to do a good job for people. And, you know, in our state, there's a lot of contractors with bad reputations.
It's a very important, you know, I tell people all the time, our biggest hurdle is the reputation of contractors.
Mm-hmm.
I would say probably 75% of the people that I've gone to their homes within 10 minutes have had a story mm-hmm. about the previous contractor or someone that they have dealt with that, you know, it leaves a bad taste in someone's mouth. And I tell people all the time, my customers or people I'm talking to, you can work with the truth.
Yeah.
Something happens, just tell them. I mean, there's some things.
You can't control every variable.
You can't. And you see it a lot, mostly in bathrooms. I don't know what it's going to look like.
You know, and our parents have told us this, honesty is always the best policy, right?
It is. And you want, word of mouth is important. You want your people to be happy. Obviously, you want to grow the business. That's very important.
But I can see the passion in you since you've taken on this role. And even when I've called you and you're like, hey, I got to go, I got to deal with, you're very focused on making sure that your client is happy, which is important.
Yeah. Last year we did a lot of incredibly large remodel jobs where I think one project I worked 128 straight days without a day off, and long days. And I think a lot of that comes from my youth working in agriculture. That to my detriment, I will just hyper focus, on the work, mm-hmm. And which bothers my wife quite a bit. But also too, it's like, you got to make those sacrifices. They're incredibly important.
Hey, we all got bills to pay.
We all got bills to pay. We've had a plan. My business partner and I have had a plan to, how fast can we get to building homes? Because that's what I've always kind of really wanted to do in construction. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of jumping the line on that.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how that project goes.
It's a cool, so far, the design of the home is great. It's just building homes is not cheap nowadays. We went to a job site in South Salem where a 2,100 square foot home on its own piece of land. I mean, you're talking the lot is incredibly small, and it was $700,000.
Man. That had some high-end finishes in it.
No, but that's a thing. It didn't.
Really?
It had good finishes. It had really good finishes.
Yeah. Whew.
But it wasn't anything crazy.
What was that, 350 a square foot?
I mean, do the math, but it's quite a bit. Yeah. But it was a very nice home, for sure, and which new construction should be very nice. So I'm not interested in doing developments. I'm interested in doing one-offs.
Custom.
Yeah, custom.
And it's Archer Construction.
Archer Construction Remodel LLC.
Okay.
We've been around for a couple years now.
Mm-hmm.
We started off just roofing, mm-hmm. But now we do a lot of kitchens. We still do some roofing work, but...
Yeah, I mean, any realtor will tell you the best bang for your buck is kitchens and baths as far as for resale.
For sure. I will say that if you are going to do one, every home I've done the last year or more, we've gone to it's shaker cabinets right now are really popular,
mm-hmm.
and white uppers and sometimes white lowers and a navy blue island or gray. Every home.
Really?
And look, I'll paint your cabinets pink if you want. I don't care.
Yeah, whatever floats your boat.
Whatever floats your boat. I do what you want me to do. But there's been a lot of that lately, which is whatever. I mean, that's a customer's always right, kind of in a way. But I want to start doing stained cabinets. We talk about it all the time. Man, I want to start doing stained cabinets again.
Yeah.
Just something a little different.
Yeah, just spice it up.
Well, you got to think too, social media drives the perception of what a home should look like now on the interior, especially a kitchen.
Yeah.
So
is it navy and then is it gold? Is it gold hardware?
I've done brushed nickel,
mm-hmm.
Which looks all right in black.
Huh.
Gold would look great. We just did a house. We're finishing it up. Where the uppers are white and the lowers are black, and then really dark engineered bamboo floors in the kitchen. And it's so great. I haven't done black lowers yet, and it turned out fantastic. I really like the look.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can do to change your space, right? We all need a little bit of spice in our lives. So when you go mix something up a little bit, do something different. My wife painted our brick wall in our bedroom, navy blue. And at first I was like, you want to do navy blue? But now I really like it.
White was popular for a long time. Yeah. You know, that house that we're just finishing up, we tore down the chimney. Mm. That's the first one I've done, which I've been wanting to do that.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. It was a cool thing to do. I hadn't done it before. I mean, it's not rocket science. I mean, right. It's just machine.
Start at the top and work your way down.
Work on the bottom, patch the roof. Yeah, yeah, it's really easy. And that customer is getting a new roof soon too. But that was so much fun. And we think just how things had turned out when we got below the floor, that the chimney was actually added later on.
Yeah.
Which was very interesting.
Which is odd that you would do that, you know.
Once, I know. Yeah. My house was built at the same time at this house, same 2 years, and mine was done when it was newly constructed.
Yeah, which makes more sense. When you're at the bottom, and that's the time to put the chimney in.
Yeah, when you don't have drywall going on in your house. Because the drywall around it was from, 2017.
I think that's the advantage that will appeal to your brain when you're building a home from the ground up, is you can think of all those cool little things and do it while you have the studs exposed. Like, you know, just little cool outlet features or, you know, lighting things.
There's so much because of social media.
Surround sound.
Yeah, well, and also one of the great things about, you know, Instagram, and I don't use Pinterest, but a lot of people do, that more of these specialized companies have social media now, right? Because that's what's important.
Mm-hmm.
So you're finding a lot of cool stuff on social media. I can't tell you how, you know, like people stop doing stone front on homes. So masonry has really, it's harder to find masons now.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a company out of Canada called Evolve where it's synthetic, and it could be nailed on with a brad nailer. So you can still get a stone front of your house without having to mortar it on.
Could you use that to resurface a chimney too?
Yeah. I mean, it's called Evolve Stone, maybe.
Because my wife wants to do that on one of our chimneys because it's got that sloppy brick from the 70s, you know? Where they just didn't, the grout is really sloppy.
Yeah.
And it was a look back then.
Honestly,
some people like it.
No,
but
it's just, I like perfection.
Yeah.
Mine is at home. It just depends on what's behind your brick. Mm-hmm. But let's say you did like a electric or a gas insert and you built something around it and you could do that. Go on their Instagram. It is really cool.
We did a stone face on the inside because we did a wood stove insert, but on the outside, it still got that, you know, sloppy brick. And the frogs love it. It gives them a place to hang out, you know.
For sure.
But it's just not a look we're really excited about.
No, and I think that, I mean, every customer is different on what they have, their idea of the perfect.
Oh, my wife has a lot of different dreams. And they call me the dream crusher sometimes because I have to say, hey, honey, I don't want to go drop $80,000 on the yard right now. Everything's so expensive. And we live in a hilly area, so everything involves a retaining wall.
Yeah,
and
yours is going to be exceptionally expensive.
Yeah.
For sure. Mine is, because my home's from the late 70s, the kitchen's, you know, god awful. The bathrooms need to be done. And my wife's like, when are you going to do ours? And it's like, I do it every day.
I think I've done a lot of loans for a lot of contractors over the years, and their houses are always half done because they'll get started, but then they get pulled to a customer project and then they don't want to deal with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so they'll get it to a point where it's functional. And so usually when it comes up is when they go to sell the property, it's like, oh, I actually got to do these projects. Yeah. So then their wives never get to actually live in the nice finished thing.
I mean, you did me a solid back in the day. My mortgage is so good. I'm probably not going to leave this place for a while.
Yeah.
So she'll get there. Yeah. Well, we're going to do my bathroom sometime this summer probably, because it's you know, like every 1,200 square foot home, the main bathroom is actually not that big.
Yeah.
And it's a quick project.
Well, that's what's nice. Small spaces, you can do nice finishes and it'll look really good and it doesn't have to cost that much money.
Yeah, the real expense, I mean, custom cabinets are expensive, but in my opinion, it's kind of the way to go.
You got a good connection there.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, because my uncle makes cabinets for everything. But the issue I see is that, you know, we did Lowe's cabinets in someone's home, mm-hmm. Which were fine. We do the measuring, so the onus is on us to make sure it's right.
Yeah.
But they didn't send the crown molding.
Oh.
and it was painted.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to match. It's not color that I could get. Mm-hmm. So it was proprietary to Lowe's or that manufacturer they use. So that took another 3 weeks. Well, that's, though their kitchen is usable, it's 3 more weeks I got to wait to get paid.
Well, plus they're also looking at it going, when it's not there.
And it wasn't quite right, and we ended up not using it. Mm. So it created a whole other issue. The great thing about the cabinet maker is, like, I'll call them.
Yeah, and they'll be there to look at it.
He is my family, but also, too, it's a local company.
Mm-hmm.
Been like, hey, this is X, Y, and Z's happened. Can we? The remedies are much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not waiting on a... Lowe's does not care about you.
Yeah, no. Those big corporations, it's not that they don't care, they just can't. They're too big to care.
They can't
care.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, it's not that they don't. And that's a funny thing. I shouldn't say they don't, because the person I worked with for that is awesome.
Yeah.
And if
the locals do, they just are out of control. Anytime you're with a big corporate conglomerate, stuff just moves slow.
Well, the manufacturer of those cabinets was in Ohio. Mm-hmm. But one of their manufacturers is Independence. Why couldn't you just have them make?
Yeah, right here.
It's just right here.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, we should probably wrap it up and hit the gun show, don't you think?
Yeah.
We covered some topics today. We danced a little bit, but that's
better than usual for us.
Yeah,
for
we did
sure.
pretty good. And we didn't expect to end it talking about construction, but hey, that's what you're doing right now.
Construction's a lot of fun. So, I like it a lot. I like just.
And everybody loves home stuff. I don't know how you couldn't, you know?
It's weird, man. The more I got, because I started 20 years ago in commercial construction, mm-hmm. and then I had a little stint in agriculture. But it's so funny, like, now on Instagram, that's all I'm looking at is, like, home remodels.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Like, maybe I want to try this.
Yeah.
And it's
it gives you ideas.
Well, it's not so much on, I'm a guy, just forewarning if you ever use me, I'm not so good at design.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that's the idea. I have people
yeah.
that are very good at it.
And a lot of homeowners know what they want to a point.
It's actually been kind of beneficial in a mm-hmm. way. There was one customer I did not end up working with him, but he was from the Bay Area and he had a home up here in West Salem. And he was flying up a designer mm-hmm. like twice a month.
Wow.
For his home remodel.
Yeah, that's a expensive job.
That's a lot of money right there.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being here. We were talking before we got started. You were on episode 2 and 3.
Was it 2 and 3?
Well, that's what we were saying. I don't know if that's... I know 2 for sure.
Maybe 2 and 4?
Or 2 and 6 or somewhere. Somewhere in the early days.
What number is this?
Now we're in the 40s.
In the 40s?
We're in the 40s. Yeah.
I'm excited for when we hit 100.
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun. And, you know, we try to put out at least once a month, but sometimes, you know, life gets busy and we go do things. And so.
Well, we've been meaning to do this for
a while.
Couple of months.
And we've had a few different topics we've talked about doing. And then, you know, this was just the Senate Bill 769 was such a hot subject right now.
It's very important that people.
And you were there. I mean, you were at the public hearing.
Just real quick before we go, when I walked out, there's two things. Senator Nash went on a trip with his son before his son left for the military. They hiked like 80-some miles through the wilderness. They didn't see one deer.
That's
87 miles, I think it was. That was striking to me. The second feeling that I had or something I thought about when I walked out of that room at the end, what the hell else is going on in this building that I don't know about?
Right. Like the government at work kind of stuff.
The government at work. I've never been involved in any way, really.
Yeah.
And I left that and I was like, what else is going on in this building that I don't know about?
Right. What other meeting went on at the same time as this one?
A lot of people in suits. I look how I look right now just as a regular Joe, you know. And then I was telling my wife that. I said, what the heck else is going on in my state? I don't even know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe, I don't know, for just people listening to this is just get more involved in some way or at least become more accustomed to finding out about something before it happens.
Yeah. I think oftentimes we're reactive and not proactive.
Absolutely.
And in spaces that we care about, like even this change they're making to the mule deer hunting.
Yeah.
They'd been talking about it for several years.
Very long time.
But until it came out in the synopsis this year, nobody paid attention.
No one cared.
We're like, are they really cutting it down to this many units? You know, and everybody freaked out. Well, it's like, well, they've been telling you. And to be fair, it is challenging to find information sometimes. Like, you know things are going on.
Especially with the government.
But trying to find the public. Well, I tried to call this is off topic, but I was helping a client and I was trying to get tax information in Chicago, Illinois. I got transferred 7 times before I left a message, you know, and it was on a property tax situation.
Man, try building the house.
Oh, I imagine.
You go to, I mean, our Marion County is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
We did one in Deschutes, which is even better. My family did. You got to know the right questions to ask and who to ask them to, because, you know, I spent like 3 hours there the other day and they're like, hey, have you talked to this guy? The last person's like, hey, have you talked to this guy? I'm like, that's the first guy I talked to.
Right. You went full circle at the end of it. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, oh no, that's perfectly fine. Oh. It's like, why wouldn't you just no one's volunteering information these days.
Isn't AI going to fix all this for us?
Golly, I hope so.
We'll see.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Chris. Thanks for coming on, buddy.
Absolutely.
Good to see you.